Hello and welcome to this episode of the IEA's Digital Programme. I'm Emma Revel, Head of Communications, and today I'm joined by my colleague, Dr. Christian Niemitz, Head of Political Economy, and Sam Bowman, Director of Competition Policy at the International Centre of Law and Economics and Senior Fellow at the Adam Smith Institute to talk about the future of NHS reform. But first, don't forget you can subscribe to the IEA's content to make sure you never miss an episode. You can find us on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter at IEA London. Our podcasts are available on Apple, Spotify and Podbean, and the IEA Daily Newsletter will deliver everything straight to your inbox every morning. You can visit the IEA website, iea.org.uk, to subscribe. Christian, we'll just go straight into it. The IEA has been arguing for reform of the health service for years, but I think you and I would both admit that, unfortunately, we haven't got very far. Absolutely. You yourself have written a report called Universal Healthcare Without the NHS, which looks at international examples of social insurance models which deliver much better outcomes than the NHS and put patients at the centre of the system. But criticism always comes back on us that we are pushing a US-style system. Why do you think the myth persists that it's the US model or the NHS and all other examples are just ignored?
Well, I used to think that the reason why people are so emotionally attached to the NHS is simply that they don't know much about alternatives. They know about the US model, of course, because we talk about it all the time, and they know a bit about what healthcare was like in the Victorian era, and therefore stick to those examples. But I no longer believe that that is the reason for the attachment to the NHS. I now actually think it's more the other way around. It's more that the emotional attachment to the NHS is there first, but people don't quite know how to justify that when asked, when pushed. So they try to rationalize it in some way. If somebody says, well, what is so great about the NHS? And you have to come up with something that sounds reasonable. It's a bit like if somebody asks you to justify your taste in music or your taste in food and cuisines. It's something that you can't give a rational reason for. You just like what you like. Your tastes are just the way they are. But nonetheless, if somebody asks you, so if somebody puts you on the spot and asks you to verbally justify it, you would probably come up with something. It's just that that would probably not be the real reason why you like that style of music or that type of cuisine. It's just some rhetoric that you've read somewhere from maybe a musical critic or a food critic saying something that sounds reasonable, and you would just repeat that. And I think that's what happens with the NHS, that there is just this attachment which comes first, and then contrasting it to the US or to the Victorian infirmary, that is just a way of rationalizing it. And it's more that in order to sustain this idea that the NHS is unique and wonderful, you have to quite deliberately blank out other models. But I think it is the emotional attachment that's there first, and what comes afterwards is a post hoc rationalization.
And I suppose as well, if you're presented with evidence like you do in the report I just mentioned, that so many more people would survive cancer, for example, if they were treated under the German system or the Belgian system or the Dutch system, that's obviously quite shocking and should really upset people and push them towards reform. The only way to resist that, I suppose, is to say, oh, well, the NHS is actually brilliant. You have to sort of be in denial about it, right?
Yes. I mean, it's generally not a bad thing if a country has some institution that everyone can rally around, some national myth, some founding myth. It's like in France, they celebrate Bastille Day and the anniversary of the French Revolution as if that was a great thing when actually the French Revolution was a total disaster. But in fact, there's nothing wrong with having these national stories that people tell themselves. It's just that in our case, the NHS isn't just a national myth. It is also an actual healthcare system where you go for actual treatment and actual healthcare, and that's why there's a conflict. I mean, France wouldn't benefit, I would say, if they adopted a more critical view of the French Revolution. It's something that you can't change anyway. It's in the past. It doesn't have any direct implication for policy today. So there's no reason why you shouldn't romanticize it and create a story around it. Why not? I just wish we would do that with something which is similarly, which has no real world repercussions today. Some founding myth, something like St. George, that's perfectly harmless. That's absolutely fine. But don't do that with healthcare, because we also need, the NHS is also an actual healthcare system. And that's the problem here.
Sam, you appeared on the very first episode of Live with Littlewood, which is the IEA's weekly discussion show. And when NHS reform came up with the topic, you said, in my opinion, we should just give up on health. Don't spend any more time on it. You can never convince anybody and you should just cut our losses. I mean, for that, you meant sort of people like us on the centre right. I certainly understand the impulse, because many think tanks, including the ASI, where you were formerly executive director, have been promoting reform for many years with almost no change. So why do you think we should give up and focus our energies elsewhere?
Well, for a few reasons. I'll kind of kick off by saying I agree with Christian that it's basically not much good. I agree with Christian that it could be a lot better. But actually, I think that the convincingness of Christian's arguments to me make me even more convinced that it's pointless in making these arguments to other people, because it seems to me that the evidence is so strong and so kind of almost overwhelming that, you know, a Dutch or a Danish or French or German style approach to healthcare would be superior. And even, I have to say, in some ways, an American approach, you know, we can talk about this later, but I want to give a contrarian defense of the American system, which I want to be clear to all watchers. Only I believe, nobody else in this is supportive of an American system, but I will give a defense. But when you look at the polling, it's just completely obvious that not only do people like the idea of the NHS, they like the reality of the NHS. Now, it's true that every time there's an election, we have kind of 5 days to save the NHS. It becomes this huge issue where basically the centre-left parties kind of use it and use the threat of the kind of centre-right parties eviscerating the NHS to win votes. But people actually think the NHS that they experience is really good. YouGov does a regular poll asking people how good are their local NHS services, how good are national services, and consistently the results are very high. Now, obviously, recent numbers are a little bit skewed by COVID, but we're talking about 78% of people saying that local services are good, 68% of people saying that national services are good, and even pre-COVID, the numbers aren't that much lower. And when you ask people what they think of European healthcare in comparison to, so not American, but European healthcare in comparison to the NHS, only 15% think that the NHS is worse than European healthcare systems. They think 33% think it's better, 33% think it's the same, the rest don't know. So it's only a very tiny number of people think that, you know, when you ask them, European systems are better and so on. And this is, as you say, after years of us trying to change their minds and use what I think is really convincing evidence and really, really convincing models of reform that would kind of give them everything they want, this sort of free at the point of use model, but be a much, much more efficient system. So why do people like it? One obvious answer is that they're not aware of the superior options available, or they're not aware, and I think that that's probably part of it. Another potential explanation is what Dan Klein has called the people's romance. There's a sense that people love being in things together, and where once maybe military conflict or national service or the army or even imperialism would have given people a sense of kind of everybody is joined in this national crusade to do something. In the UK, perhaps the NHS fulfills that role. And, that would kind of fit with this idea that it's a national religion. And, you know, people say, well, it's a national religion, da, da, da. But why is the UK system a national religion, but not, say, the Dutch healthcare system, a national Dutch religion? And it could be that there's something special about doing it through the state and doing it through this sort of top-down model that we have in the NA, or kind of centralized model that we have. Or there's an idea that the economist Robin Hanson's put forward, which is that it's about, it's a kind of tribal primitive feeling of wanting to look after the weak members of the tribe. Not because we're altruistic, but because the weak members of the tribe are the ones who hold you back. And so we have a kind of an evolutionary impulse to try to make sure that the weakest members of the tribe are still quite fit. And also to show off that we have that kind of elites have so many resources available to them that they can afford to look after the weak members. You know, so in a kind of tribe of hunter-gatherers, the kind of alpha male or the kind of chief shows that he is the strongest by being able to share food with the weakest. And that's a real symbol or signal of how strong he is. And then there's a final kind of contrarian argument, which is that the NHS forces us to ration our spending on healthcare. that a lot of healthcare spending is either done in a sort of slight fit of, you know, almost madness, and it's understandable when you get sick, especially when you get seriously ill. You know, a sort of madness sets in. You become incredibly worried about your health, about your family, what they'll do without you. And it may not be rational for you to spend the amount of money that you would be willing to spend in a more kind of free and liberal system. So there could be a kind of contrarian argument. I'm not really sure if I believe it, but defense of the NHS for that. Now, all of these things are me basically saying that I don't think it's... I don't think people are looking at the evidence and saying, well, I think the NHS gives us the best bang for our buck, and therefore, you know, we just need to make better arguments to them. I'm sort of saying that people's support for the NHS is orthogonal to the sorts of arguments we can make. And if that's the case, then the arguments we make are just going over their heads or just not interesting to them. You know, I don't want to sound like we know better and people who disagree with us are broken in some way. They just have different priorities to the ones we're addressing. And so the cost of doing all this is the simple economic principle of opportunity cost. When we talk about the NHS, we're not talking about things like housing or tax or trade or innovation and entrepreneurship. You know, things where I do think we can move the dial and where I think probably the benefits would be a lot more significant, because ultimately the difference between different healthcare systems, you know, it's not nothing, but it's not the same as the difference between, say, fixing the planning system and not fixing the planning system, or moving to a much more efficient form of capital taxation. These are things that could have a really significant long-term impact on growth, and that means that we have many more resources. We can live with a fairly inefficient healthcare system if we're richer. And so to me, it's kind of focusing on things that will make us richer, where we actually can move the dial politically, that might do the job. I think, I know I've spoken for a long time, but I think the best argument against what I'm saying is that this kind of proves too much. If we concede that the NHS, you know, if we just basically cut our losses and say, you know, the NHS is its own thing, don't worry about that, we're not going to argue about that, then the counter argument is, well, you know, if the NHS is really great for healthcare, why not have an NHS for education? Or why not have an NHS for food or an NHS for housing? And I think that is a pretty strong argument against what I'm saying. And it might be that the reason to argue about the NHS is not to win that argument, but just to stop losing ground in other areas.
I mean, Christian, what do you think about that? Do you think we should keep defending our ground? Because, you know, we haven't got anywhere with healthcare reform, and it looks probably unlikely that we will do so in the next 5 to 10 years. Do we need to hold the line even if we can't push it any further forward? Or are we better off focusing our energy on policy areas where we could have more of an impact?
Yeah, I agree with them that this is a lost cause. I'm not expecting us to win on this. It's when I wrote Universal Healthcare Without the NHS, I was under no illusion that this would get adopted over the next 5 years or within my lifetime even. That's not the reason why I keep talking and writing about it. It's more that there are political debates where it is possible to say, okay, I've lost the argument, I accept it, I no longer take part in this discussion. I just accept defeat. There are areas where that is possible. Brexit would maybe be a good example. I'm not a Brexiteer, I still think it's a mistake to leave the single market, but I'm not going to spend the rest of my life moaning about Brexit. So that's an area where I'm just unilaterally exiting the debate and cutting my losses, accepting that I've lost the argument, and that's that. But there are also debates where at least one side has an interest in perpetuating the argument forever, and that means that you cannot just unilaterally withdraw. Most of the culture war battles that we're most of the culture war issues that we're grappling with at the moment are like that. If we could come to an agreement with the woke left where we say, okay, you get to remove all the statues, all the monuments you don't like, but then you leave us alone. How about that? If that were an option, I would do it, because I think that would be worth it. But we don't have that option. If once the statues are gone, they will find something else. This is one of those debates where one side wants to keep fighting for the sake of fighting, because the fight itself is the where they is a statement of identity, a sense of purpose for them, and therefore you cannot opt out when one side just wants to keep going anyway. And healthcare is, at least in Britain, healthcare debates are a lot more like a culture war than anything else. If you look at these accusations that Sam mentioned of you're trying to privatize the NHS, I mean, if it were really about the issue, we could have stopped talking about healthcare long ago. There was, in healthcare, there was, as far as I'm aware, never a real possibility of the UK completely changing its healthcare system. No senior politician ever seriously thought about that. Nonetheless, for at least 40 years, there has always been someone claiming that there are secret plans to privatize the NHS. The latest incarnation is they're trying to sell it to Donald Trump in the guise of a UK-US trade deal. But long before that, I look at this briefly in the book. I found articles from as far back as 1980 saying the exact same thing. Somebody saying there's a secret plan to privatize the NHS. Within 5 years, it will be gone. And then we will get the American model. You can find articles from 1980 saying the exact same thing. It's always been there. And when I say there's always been someone making that case, I don't mean some irrelevant fringe figure. I'm talking about senior leading figures in the British Medical Association, people who write for the British Medical Journal, mainstream journalists for The Guardian, The New Statesman, and so on. And that's just always been there. No matter how much if the other side accepts defeat, the most fervent believers in the NHS will always accuse you of trying to privatize the NHS and replace it with a US-style system. No matter how much you declare your love for the NHS, or no matter how much you just try to disengage from it altogether, doesn't matter, they will do it anyway. So purely for self-defense purposes, we have to keep saying what the alternative actually is. We can't get around that anyway. People will hold the US system against us no matter what we do. We might as well come up with a proper argument and make it a bit harder for them. And it is harder if you bring up examples like the Netherlands and Switzerland, which have universal private systems. It's just a lot harder for an NHS defender to demonize you for making that case, because these are not scary places. Nobody ever said, I wanted to go on holiday in Switzerland or in the Netherlands, but I'm so terrified I might get sick and then have to go to a private hospital. And nobody ever canceled a holiday to Switzerland or the Netherlands for that reason. So we are on strong ground here, and we have to keep defending it.
Okay. Coronavirus has focused minds on healthcare systems both here and across the world. So we're in this weird paradox where the NHS's shortcomings are being highlighted, but at the same time we're on our doorsteps clapping for doctors and nurses and hero worshipping the institution. I mean, if we thought the NHS was a political tool before the pandemic, it's even more so now. I spotted earlier in the week Health Secretary Matt Hancock appeared in the chamber of the House of Commons wearing socks that said "Protect the NHS." I'm not sure how respectful that is, but it's clearly a symbol. He's clearly trying to make a political point. Sam, you've talked about depoliticising the NHS as sort of being a halfway house between the reforms we would like but don't seem achievable and the current status quo. How do you think depoliticising the NHS would work? Or do you think it's just a nice idea that's never going to happen because it's Britain and we love the NHS?
Well, this may be slightly fantasy, but hear me out. In countries that have really significant ethnic divides, so Northern Ireland is an example, occasionally the model of government that's used is what's called consociational. And in a consociational system, it's basically guaranteed that different ethnic groups will always have a seat at the table in government. So you enforce coalitions on groups that basically hate each other and say that in perpetuity, let's say in Northern Ireland, people from the Republican side will always be guaranteed that they'll be part of the government, as will people on the Unionist side. And so in Northern Ireland, you end up with coalitions between the DUP and Sinn Féin. They basically people who hate each other and have tried to kill each other in the past, but they are kind of forced to work together because the alternative is so much worse. And I think this is a model in Rwanda as well. This is a kind of approach that is maybe not perfect. It's not a perfect democracy, but it might be a way of getting people who really dislike each other to work together. So my suggestion would be a consociational model of NHS governance. And what you could do is split out governance of the NHS from the rest of government. So we obviously don't want to have a consociational model between the left and the right when it comes to kind of education or tax policy. But we might say the NHS is such a precious thing. It's such an important issue. And it's something that really we don't want to be left up to day-to-day politics, that we're going to split it out. And we're going to have a kind of consociational system where there's a guaranteed seat at the table for people on the right. There's a guaranteed, and when I say people on the right, I mean members of the Conservative Party, to be honest. I think on the NHS, they're not particularly right wing. But, you know, I'm really just talking about cutting losses here. So you kind of guarantee seats at the table for people from all of the major parties in proportion to the number of votes they have in the last election, we'll say, and say, you know, on a national level, the big decisions that will be made by a kind of independent body, a bit like the Bank of England or the Competition and Markets Authority, things to do with spending. You know, we can set up all sorts of arcane bureaucratic mechanisms to set up ways of kind of deciding what the level of spending should be. Or we could even have a national referendum to decide, you know, how much should we actually spend. And each year people can increase their tax bill if they want. We could tie it to something like national insurance, or they could vote to have a cheaper tax bill and they could cut it. Something like that, I think, wouldn't be perfect. But it might separate out the question of how to govern the NHS from other political issues, so that people who want a, you know, big government for the NHS, but maybe don't want big government in things like education or in things like tax, can do that and can have their cake and eat it too. And kind of fundamentally, what it will do is allow conservatives, and I say this, and I'm not really, you know, I didn't vote for the conservatives at the last election, but it's kind of poisonous to them and to the right to go into every election with the idea that, with voters being told that if you don't vote for the other party, then you're going to lose the NHS. It just means that every other issue gets corrupted by people's real deep, deep love of the NHS. And so splitting it out in the way I'm describing would allow us to just separate out the issues. It could still be, we could still have votes, we could still have, ultimately, and probably still be politicians running it, but it could be in a totally parallel system of government for this one institution.
I mean, that's a great idea, Sam. It's certainly not a model for the NHS I've ever heard before. It's probably worth considering. Christian, what do you think? Do you think, I mean, Sam said it might be a sort of fantasy idea. Do you think it could work?
I can't see why not. If we could get to a model like that, then maybe, then I would probably agree that once it's just taken outside of the debate, then I'd say let's rather not... Let sleeping dogs lie and don't go there again. But as long as we don't have a depoliticized model, I'm afraid we'll have to keep doing what we do. And depoliticizing the NHS is, as an idea, is not new. Actually, health secretaries have been talking about this for, again, at least 40 years. There is an interesting book on this from the Health Foundation, where they have interviews and essays of the last, I think, 10 or even 12 health secretaries, going back to at least the late 80s. And several of them are bringing up that topic. They talk about what were the main challenges during your time in office. And several of them do say, we try to take the politics out of it, depoliticize it in some way. And they always say, but yeah, in the end, we got nowhere. For several reasons. There's, first of all, it is, at least now, it's the single biggest item of public spending. NHS spending is something like is close to 8% of GDP, so that's the biggest proportion of the budget, and it's also an area that lots of people care about a lot. So this isn't like monetary policy, where the average Joe doesn't have a huge interest in it. It's a technical issue. It's not something that that people talk about in at the pub, whereas healthcare is a much more emotive issue. And a bigger issue, so that there is always going to be some public interest and therefore some political debate around it. And what several of these health secretaries say, why it didn't get very far, was just that they're saying, no matter what you do, structurally, when something goes wrong, when we have something like the Med Staffordshire scandal, or now the clear failure to prepare well for the pandemic, or get a testing regime running, when something like that happens, there is no way the public is ever going to say, but that's got nothing to do with the health secretary, because it's now less politicized. And there's no way a politician in that position could say, sorry, that's got nothing to do with me, leave me alone. You need to talk to the chief executive of the NHS or to the local commissioning board or whatever, nothing to do with me. It's just a part of the psychology also, more than the actual healthcare structure, that people associate the NHS with what the government does. And that is the perception, that it is run from the Department of Health, whether that's true or not. And this is reinforced by the fact that we cannot, that there is this strong social taboo against criticizing the NHS. So when something goes wrong, the only thing you're left with really is to blame the politician in charge. You can always blame the government of the day. There's absolutely no social taboo against that. But there is a strong social taboo against criticizing the NHS. So therefore, there is this focus on the politicians in charge. And when these people know that they'll get the blame anyway, they will also want to have some say.
Very true. So I've got one final question on NHS reform, but is there anything else you wanted to add, Sam, just before I wrap up?
I wanted to just make a super contrarian argument in favour of the NHS, so the US system, which is, when it comes to climate change, everybody knows that the UK on its own isn't going to make any difference to the path of climate change and the path of global emissions. We're a tiny, tiny country, tiny share of global output. Anything we do is only really about gestures. And yet, I think it's really important that those gestures are met. And I think it's really important that the UK does meet the goals that we think that the world should meet, because we'd be hypocrites otherwise. Now, in healthcare, we are hypocrites, because in healthcare, everybody agrees that innovation in medicine and new drugs and new treatments are absolutely crucial. And really, you know, all of those things about how we arrange the NHS or how we do social insurance or how we pay for it, all those things kind of pale in comparison to the availability of new drugs and new treatments and new devices for people who are sick. It's those things really that make a difference to us living longer and living better lives. And yet the NHS system, and in fact many European systems, which are filled with price controls, are anathema to innovation and are completely the opposite type of system you would want if you were trying to maximize medical innovation. And in fact, almost all medical innovation in the world takes place either in the US or funded in expectation of being sold in the US. And this huge amount of spending that takes place in the US on healthcare ends up funding enormous amounts of research and development into new drugs, into new treatments and things like that. And then the rest of the world free rides on that. So the NHS's main argument, the main point that people make in favor of the NHS, is that we're able to negotiate really, really tough deals with drug manufacturers. But the only reason we're able to do that is because the drug manufacturers can sell their drugs at high prices to American consumers. They can make the money they need to actually make the funding for those things viable, the research funding for those things viable. And then, you know, further down the chain, you get countries like the UK, which really don't matter very much. But, you know, you might as well cover some of your costs by selling at a discount rate to countries like the UK. So we're free riding on American innovation and American spending. Now, maybe you think that's okay. Maybe you think free riding is good. But I don't think you can say simultaneously that it's good for us to free ride on innovation that takes place in the US with our system when it comes to healthcare. But it isn't good for us to free ride on other countries cutting their emissions when the UK and the UK to just continue belching out CO2 as much as it wants. I don't think it's possible to hold those two views. Either you think we should be a global citizen and do our bit in contributing both to reducing CO2 emissions and to spending lots and lots of money on new drugs and new treatments in healthcare, or you think we should be basically a rogue state, free riding on the contributions and the spending of other countries. Right now, we are a rogue state when it comes to healthcare, and that's something that I think really should change. And that's one really, really strong argument in favor of the US system. It might not be the best one to live under, but it's certainly the best one for the rest of the world to exist.
I mean, it's almost as if every different healthcare system in the world has its own strengths and weaknesses, and maybe we should learn from all of them. Always one of the greatest things, statistics about the NHS when we talk about technology and innovation, is the fact that it's still the world's largest consumer of fax machines. Who still has fax machines? This system is out of date. It needs to change. I'm going to bring this conversation to an end. Thank you both for joining me. But I'm just going to ask, if you could make one change to the NHS without, you know, you're in charge for a day, you've got no opposition, you could make one change, what would it be and why? We'll start with Sam.
Following on from what I've just been saying, I'd probably stop trying to negotiate cheaper drug prices, or I would use the money that we save in doing that to finance more research and development of new drugs, or to kind of offer certain promised prices for the development of new drugs to incentivize private sector development, so that we're free riding less on the US system, and so that we get more healthcare innovation.
Better treatments for everyone. Christian, what would yours be?
I'm torn between several. One strong contender would be to give people the right to opt out of the NHS and take out private insurance instead and get a tax refund that is more or less equivalent to what your healthcare would probably have cost. If you have a social insurance system, that is automatically the way it works, that if you change from one insurer to another, then the money follows you, your own contribution plus some adjustment that depends on your own personal health risk. And that would be a way of introducing that sort of principle where, let's say, if you are in reasonably good health and your expected healthcare costs aren't going to be high, then that tax refund you're getting won't be very high either. Whereas if you are in bad health, if you are a bad risk, then the tax refund would be huge. So you keep the redistribution. This is not about stopping redistribution from healthy people to sick people. You keep that principle going, but you just decouple that from the NHS as an organization. You put that into the tax system and then allow people to get their healthcare in other ways. Opting out doesn't mean that you will have no contact with the NHS anymore. You could have private insurers as well contracting with the NHS, having contracts with NHS hospitals, just paying the standard price for the procedures that they are using. And in that way, you diversify the system. You allow private insurers, could be cooperative insurers, you could have something like what existed before the NHS, the friendly societies, cooperative insurance, mutual insurance associations, trade unions running their own schemes, which is what happens in countries that don't have a national health service. And you could, at the margins, revive a bit of that tradition, and it would still be voluntary. If you're happy with the NHS, and you don't want any change, you don't have to do anything. For you, things will then just go on. This proposal would be cost neutral. People would only get the tax refund that is equivalent to their expected healthcare costs. So if you are in great health, you would still be obliged to subsidize the healthcare costs of people who are not as fortunate as you. That principle would not be touched, but you could get your healthcare in other ways. Second contender would be just to have a flat rate co-payment, 10% of the bill with some exemptions, because even 1% would make a difference. But I think there's a big psychological difference between getting something for free that creates this feeling of gratitude. If we paid a little bit, even if it's just £5 for a procedure, I think that would change attitudes a bit towards it. So either one of those two.
I mean, that's very true. The more you pay for something, the better the service you're expecting to receive, right? So I feel very bad that Christian got two. Sam, if you had a second choice, do you have a second choice?
No, I mean, I would do what I could to, I mean, I would basically try to depoliticize it. That's kind of a given. But, you know, on the point Christian was making earlier, you know, ultimately the Minister for Health will still be answerable to, you know, still be held accountable. I would basically just say the Minister for Health or the Secretary of Health role is something that we have a national vote for, like a president every 5 years, and anybody can run for it. You get to, you know, the main question is, how do you decide what the level of funding should be? Because the danger is just that people will say, well, you know, we should increase corporation tax to 50% to fund an extra X billion on the NHS. And that will be a problem, because unrestrained kind of taxation of things that people think sound like really good, but things sound really good, but, you know, maybe don't realize will have quite bad negative economic effects, could be really bad. But some way of splitting out the running, management, governance of the NHS from the rest of politics, I think, would just make it a lot easier when it comes to other political debates to cool things down and get people to focus on other issues than how much they love the NHS and how terrified they are about the 3 days left to stop the NHS from being privatised.
All right, plenty of ideas for people to consider. I'm going to link to Christian's report, Universal Healthcare Without the NHS, in the show notes. So if you'd like to read more and find out, you can find it in, down there. Thank you very much for joining me. Thanks to Sam and to Christian. Thank you for watching and listening. And also thank you to the IEA supporters, without whom our work would not be possible. If you'd like to make a donation to support our work, whether it's this digital programme, our academic research, or our outreach with students across the country, you can find out more information on our website, iea.org.uk. Thank you.